And with me this morning is Dr. Stanley Inhorn, who has retired as chairman, as director of the State Hygiene Lab, and he's had many, many positions through the University Medical School throughout his tenure. My recommendation for doing this with Dr. Inhorn was that he filled in where wherever he was needed, so he has a very fine reputation. Dr. Inhorn, do you want to tell us where you were born and a little bit about your early life?
Thank you, Anne. I was born in Philadelphia and grew up there until I was about 7 years old, in which time our family moved to Cleveland. And so I grew up in a suburb of Cleveland, Cleveland Heights, and essentially all my schooling was there. And went to Cleveland Heights High School. And then...
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I had one sister who is still living. She's 6.5 years older than I am, so we weren't that close because she was, you know, much older. And she went away to Carnegie Tech, it was called, college in Pittsburgh. She was an artist. And she did about 2 years. And then during the World War II, she came back to Cleveland and worked in the manufacturing industry, you know, war-related, where she did tool design.
Oh, my goodness.
Right. And so I was just a little too young to get into World War II, but like everybody else, we had a victory garden. And I saved wrappers from chewing gum things to make into aluminum balls, and took our old records and turned them in because they had metal in them. So I was a little too young to be in World War II. However, when I graduated high school, the war was just over, but the draft was still on. And so I had to decide where to go to college. And I was always interested in science, and my major interest was in microbiology. And there weren't too many colleges that offered undergraduate bacteriology, but one that did was Purdue, and so I applied and was accepted there. But after talking to a lot of teachers and friends, they thought it would be kind of foolish to enroll and then be drafted. So I had an alternative plan, which was to go to a local college, which at that time was called Western Reserve University in Cleveland. It is now Case Western Reserve. In any event, I did enroll at Western Reserve, and I was having to decide what major I should take, because they did not have a bacteriology department or even give courses. And at Western Reserve, their strongest science department was chemistry rather than biology. So I did become a chemistry major. My activities at the time, while I was in college, since I was living at home, joined a fraternity, and was on the wrestling team, played in the orchestra. I've always been a musician, and I play the violin. And with some friends, we formed a quartet, and we did some performances. So I had a lot of good social life, even though living at home was, you know, was not ideal. It was satisfying.
What did your parents do?
My father was a buyer for the May Company. At that time, there were no other, Walmarts and things like that, and people did go downtown to the stores, and he was right off the square in Cleveland. And we lived in a very comfortable apartment on Euclid Heights Boulevard, which had a trolley car that ran right down the divided street. And so you could take that trolley, go all the way downtown, or with the bus system, go any place in Cleveland. So my 4 years at college were, you know, satisfying in many regards. But even though I did like chemistry and majored in chemistry, I did take biology courses, and so then made the decision to go to medical school. And then the question where to go to medical school, I decided that I had enough of Cleveland, even though I could stay at Western Reserve, which has a very good medical school. But after deciding on location and reputation of medical school, I then went to New York City to Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, and there lived in a large dormitory right next to the medical school for the 4 years. Medical school, again, I always knew I was going to go into science rather than a practice of medicine, and so I prepared myself to go into pathology. I did this by several means. One, I did some volunteering in the pathology department, sort of jobs which I actually did get paid. But then we had various elective periods in the third and fourth year. And I put together 2 3-month electives in the third and fourth year into a 6-month block and did research in their new cancer research department. And in that department, the chief was Alfred Gellhorn, who was a very well-established clinical oncologist. But the man running his lab was Eric Hirschberg, who had gotten his PhD at McArdle here in Madison. So when I was trying to decide what hospital I should go to for my residency, he sort of encouraged me to go to Wisconsin. And this was one of the places I looked at. Another reason I sort of favored Wisconsin was that between my third and fourth year of college, I came to Madison one summer for a National Student Association organizing conference. And after going to a streetcar college, coming to a beautiful campus, and the campus was not as crowded as it is today, staying in a lakeshore dorm, swimming in Lake Mendota when it was still clear and pure, I kept this in the back of my mind when I was looking for residencies. And I decided that I would come back to the Midwest, and I looked at various places in Chicago, Minneapolis, and chose to come to Madison. At that time, then, I entered a rotating internship, which was the common practice at that time, and made contact with the pathology department and was getting prepared to start my residency.
How many services did you rotate through in those days?
I think that it was something like 3 months of medicine, 3 months of surgery, a month of neurology. It was called neuropsychiatry, OBGYN, pediatrics, and a month or so of electives. So it was quite comprehensive.
And it was all in Madison.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Exactly, right at the hospital. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know the medical students were farmed out elsewhere, but yeah. There were only 8 interns. And it was very active. You know, every bed was filled, and they had big wards, and so you were very busy when you were an intern. then I started my residency in July of 54. Now, I should mention that in the meantime, I met a young woman in Madison, Charlie Sherburne, who was here doing graduate work in what's called physiological chemistry. It's a biochemistry department in the medical school. And I met her one January day, and I knew this was the person for me. And within just a few months, we had planned to get married. And so we got married in August of that year. In the meantime, also, there was a draft, another draft going on, including a doctor draft, a special draft of MDs. And so I was called up and had to go into the Navy in October of 1954. So Shirley was going to continue her PhD studies, and I was assigned to go into amphibious forces, and went to San Diego for a brief orientation, and then was assigned to an amphibious ship called APA. It's a troop carrier, and this ship was stationed to go to Japan. This was sort of at the end of the Korean War. So this ship stationed in San Diego then made a trip up to Seattle to get reconditioned in the Naval Yard up there. And on the way, we found that the ship was going to be decommissioned rather than to go over to Japan. And so I was reassigned to other amphibious ships called LSTs, landing craft, and I was a physician for a squadron of LSTs. At this point, Shirley decided that since I was going to stay in the States that she would come and join me, which she did. And we then spent short time in Seattle, Alameda in the Bay Area, and back down to San Diego, where I finished out my two years of duty. And during this time, we had our first child, born at Balboa Naval Hospital in San Diego, and enjoyed our tour up and down the West Coast. Then in 56, October, came back to Madison to resume my pathology residency. Now, pathology residency is interesting in that there are two main branches of pathology. One is called anatomic, where you look at slides and bodies and things like that. And the other is called clinical pathology, which is essentially all of the laboratory sections of a clinical laboratory. So I came back, whereas I ordinarily would have gone on to the autopsy service, there was already somebody assigned to that. And so I went to the State Laboratory of Hygiene, which is another interesting story. This laboratory is a public health laboratory which was founded on the UW campus. And the reason this occurred is because in the turn of the last century, turn of the 20th century, bacteriology was a booming science in the sense that for the first time, they were able to identify causative agents of disease, of infectious disease. And this all occurred in Europe with the studies of notable people like Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch, who were able to identify specific organisms that cause specific infectious diseases. And so if you wanted to learn about microbiology, you went over to Europe. And people from our school, our agricultural school, did this. And one of these people decided that he would, well, show me that book over there. Yeah, I want to get some names. One of these persons, UW faculty, was Harry Russell, and he had gone to study with Koch in Germany, and when he came back, he was the first person appointed as a bacteriology professor in the Department of Agriculture. And another person who also studied in Europe was a man by the name of Cornelius Harper. Cornelius Harper eventually became the health officer in the Department of Health in Madison. And the two of them, Russell and Harper, decided they needed a laboratory support. And they decided it should be in the university because we have other people who could enhance the scientific capabilities. So on October 1st, 1903, the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene was developed and opened in the basement room of Agricultural Hall, which was just built. One room, and they studied infections, and this was a start.
Did from around the state, did people bring samples in?
This was the idea, that it would be serving the people of the state. Mm-hmm. At the same time, La Follette was saying, you know, the bounds of the university are the bounds of the state.
Mm-hmm.
So it gave the university this outreach capability.
Mm-hmm.
As the activities increased, the laboratory was expanded and had to be relocated into South Hall. Russell became dean of the College of Agriculture, and another man by the name of Ravenel, who was a bacteriologist, was recruited to be the director of the laboratory. And he stayed also for another several years, but he left to take a job at another university. And in 1918, a southern gentleman by the name of William Stovall, who had come here for a year of training, but stayed on because he liked the situation, was named the director. And he was director for 40 years with his assistant director, M. Starr Nichols, who was a environmental chemist. And the two of them really developed this laboratory into a major institution. And during this time, the laboratory was moved to Service Memorial Institute, which is the medical school building. And it was located on the fourth and fifth floors of the old SMI building. Now, all of this is important in that Dr. Stovall not only ran the State Laboratory of Hygiene, but when the University Hospital was opened, he was asked to direct the clinical laboratories, and he ran the two operations. And it was easier when the state lab was in SMI because they were in close proximity, and they could divide the resources. And so most of the microbiology was done in the state lab, most of the clinical chemistry was done in the hospital clinical lab. So when I came here in 1953 and then started my residency really after I got back from the Navy in 1956, I was really in two, you might say, separate activities, one of anatomic pathology and one of clinical pathology. And Dr. Stovall and his cohorts at the state lab and the hospital clinical labs were the ones who were running the sections where I rotated in chemistry, hematology, microbiology, and so forth.
What does SMI mean?
Service Memorial Institute.
Mm-hmm. That was a little building that was built.
Well, it's a fairly, no, it's the main.
It's oh, it's the old, newer
it's the old,
building.
It's not the newer one. It's the old medical school building to which they have added in recent years,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's still right there. The anatomic pathology department at that time, the chairman was D. Murray Angevine. And Murray Angevine had a very good reputation as a researcher in connective tissue disease and bone disease and so forth. And it was a fairly small department. And some of the people that I knew before I left for the Navy were no longer here when I came back, but there were some new additions. Bob Coy was the renal pathologist, and we had several other people. Joe Lalish was running the med school course, the second year medical school course in pathology, and all of us as residents had to teach. At that time, there were three laboratories a week, you know, for all morning and all afternoon, and so this was a big commitment. And you learned your anatomic pathology by teaching and by doing autopsies, surgical pathology. Now, there's a very interesting little note here, and that is that Angevine's predecessor, when asked to do the surgical pathology, did not agree because of the fact that you had to be on call for frozen sections. And he was much more conservative than Angevine, and he wanted nothing to do with this. It was taken away from research. So the administrator of the hospital, the superintendent, then turned to Stovall. And Stovall actually had an anatomic pathology section of the state lab. And I should say that one of the things that Stovall thought was his responsibility was to offer a complete modern laboratory service to all physicians of Wisconsin. And when I came here, for example, there were probably 25 small hospitals in Wisconsin who had no pathologist, no pathology service. And so they would send specimens to the state lab. And Stovall usually had two or sometimes three pathologists working at the state lab. And then when he had to also do the operation of the hospital laboratory, surgical path lab, he took that over, and the person who he assigned primarily was Walter Jeske, who was the surgical pathologist at the hospital where I got training, as did other residents. And there were some other people who later joined Jeske. But when I came here then, I rotated through the surgical path section of the hospital and also the surgical path in the state lab. Now, lots of this also, in addition to the 25 hospitals, included doctor's offices where they would send biopsies, like cervical biopsies, a lot of skin. About 70% would be skin biopsies. So we had a very large acquisition, and I got to be a pretty good skin pathologist because we would do about 15,000 specimens a year. So it was kind of an interesting situation. Now, during my residency also, I was interested in the fact that there were some developments in the field of pathology which I thought were would be useful in future research. The pathology department itself, as I mentioned, had very limited resources, but in the basement of old SMI, they had a large laboratory which was shared by about three or four scientists. And they had some instruments there that could do what we will call quantitative cytology. They could measure nuclei of cells and determine the DNA content. Now this was, you know, compared to today, it was very rough, but it was the only thing that was available. And things to measure RNA content and that sort of thing. So I decided that this would be a future goal to develop these techniques and to enhance my own scientific prowess. I took a course as a graduate student in cytology with a professor of zoology by the name of Hans Ries. And this was a one-year course which I had to enroll and take for credit. And Dr. Angevine thought this would be worthwhile, and so he gave me permission to do this. And then when I came back, I started to do research combining this cytology activity with my interest in microbiology. The state lab had an excellent virus section, and it was the only virus activity in the state, so that all laboratories in the state, including those in big hospitals, would send specimens for virus isolation and culture. And so this was something that really I probably wouldn't have seen if I had been, say, in another university. You had to have a public health lab with a virus section in order to have this capability. I was doing research, and with some help from Dr. Angevine, I was able to get a grant from the American Cancer Society to continue these studies on the effects of viruses on what viruses did to gain control of cells and to change the pictures of cells, causing them to either become proliferate or to die or whatever. Now, this is also very interesting in that as I was doing this research as a resident, I was able to maintain my own tissue culture lab, do the studies, I did all the work, but I learned, you know, as I did my research. One day, a junior faculty person by the name of Dave Smith, who was a pediatrician, came to see me and said, I would wonder if you could grow up some cells for me to send to a researcher in England by the name of Charles Ford. Dave's interest was in congenital abnormalities. And this would be about 1959, all of a sudden there had been a rebirth of the field of human cytogenetics. And Dave wanted to get specimens from children with multiple congenital abnormalities and take some tissue and have me prepare it in such a way that we could send it to Dr. Ford in England to do these studies. So I agreed and I said, certainly I'd be glad to do this. And we were getting ready to ship some things to England when Dave got a telegram from Ford saying, don't send anything yet because things that have been coming to me from overseas have not succeeded, they've died off. So Dave was very disappointed, and I mentioned this to Dr. Angervine, and he said, well, why do you have to send us to England? We have somebody in the department who can do this. I said, really? Well, unbeknownst to me, in the room in the basement of SMI where I had been working was located Dr. Klaus Patel, who previously had been in the zoology department, but transferred over to pathology with his own grant money. And he had a colleague, Eva Thurman, who was originally from Finland. And indeed, they were competent in plant cytogenetics. So I talked to Klaus and he agreed. And so Dave got some more samples. I prepared them. And Klaus and Eva did what were those days known as squash preparations, where they would take these cells and squash them between a slide and a cover slip to make the chromosomes spread out on the slide so you could see them. Well, to make a long story short, this collaboration was very successful, and I think the ninth patient that Dave studied was a child with very severe congenital malformations, with actually a short lifespan. And this one was the first example that we published of what is known as the 13 trisomy syndrome. And shortly thereafter, the 18 trisomy. So it turned out to be a very productive collaboration. Dave then continued the research, and I was sort of diverted from my studies of virus effects on cells to cytogenetics because it was a very busy time. And we got some support so we could continue this. And by this time, I had finished my residency and I had to make a decision as to what to do. And there was one pathologist in Janesville who wanted me to come there because I'd done a locum tenens there. And he offered me the grant sum of $50,000. Which was a lot of money for me, who was getting very little as a resident. However, I was encouraged to stay at the university, and at this time, Dr. Stovall and Dr. Nichols had retired, and the dean decided, and the university decided, that Stovall's two jobs should be separated. That was the big operation. And so there should be a director of the hospital clinical labs and a director of the state laboratory of hygiene. The appointed director of the hospital clinical labs was Frank Larson, who was an internist but with a strong interest in laboratory science. And he asked me to come to be his assistant. The person who became director of the state laboratory of hygiene was Alfred Evans, who was also an internist with a specialization in infectious disease. Okay, so Dr. Alfred Evans had come to Wisconsin after a second tour of duty in the army in Germany, and he was a virologist. He was interested in viral infections, particularly respiratory infections, hepatitis, and other viral infections. And he was also a very excellent epidemiologist. And so he also asked me to come on as his assistant director because he needed somebody to head up the pathology section, among other things. The man who was there at the time, Evans felt, was incompetent, and he took the job as director of the state laboratory on the basis that this person would be fired, which the dean decided was appropriate. So there I was, just finishing a residency, and had to acquire, assume this directorship of this fairly large pathology section at the state lab, in addition to trying to do some research. I should also mention that in the pathology section of the state lab was a cytology laboratory. Now, Stovall had started cytology in the mid-40s, right when this field of pap smears were just introduced into laboratory science. And he sent one of the med techs to New York, where Dr. Papanicolaou was working at Cornell, and she was there for 2 months, came back, trained other people, and in 1956, the state laboratory, the American Cancer Society, and Division of Health put together a grant to the National Cancer Institute to carry out a large study of the acceptance of the pap smear by physicians in Wisconsin. And so this was a 14-county study where American Cancer Society volunteers and others helped to promote women to go to see their physicians and have pap smears done on an annual basis. And this study lasted from 56 through 59, and it really was an incentive to women to have this test done. And it was very successful. Over 65% of the women in those 14 rural counties did go and have at least one pap smear. And so the publicity from this campaign then spurred doctors around the state to want to have this done and women to want to be tested. And so the state lab then had to increase its staff, and we started a school of cytotechnology to train people. And from a very small beginning, we got up into over 100,000, maybe 150,000 women a year being tested by the pap smear. Now, also, as the students graduated from the school, they would go out to hospitals in the state and clinics, and eventually this then dispersed the work throughout the state. But in any event, I had to do all the cytology, surgical pathology, do teaching still in pathology, and Evans also created courses in public health, preventive medicine. He was actually also the chairman of preventive medicine, in addition to being director of the state lab. So he got all of the section chiefs in the state lab to get appointments in preventive medicine. So I had a joint appointment in preventive medicine and pathology. I learned a lot from Evans because he was excellent. He gave most of the lectures himself, but he got all of us involved, and I would give lectures in chronic diseases and global health and things like that. And he brought in excellent people from his acquaintances around the country to also lecture to the students. And eventually what developed were courses for medical students in the second year, epidemiology of infectious diseases. The third year was a separate course, the epidemiology of chronic diseases like diabetes, heart disease, hypertension. And in the between their third and fourth year, students were also then assigned to go to public health activities in whatever community they were located in that summer. learned what it meant to run a waterworks operation, a public health department. And so it was very, really very good training for these medical students to understand what public health really does and how it carries on things that often are, you know, below the radar screen. So for these early years of my career, where I was an assistant professor, I was busily engaged in running a cytogenetics lab, and I did get some funding to hire somebody who could do some of the scut work. And then another thing that happened was that Paytel then was relocated from the basement of SMI into the genetics building right next door to the State Laboratory of Hygiene. And we had a good collaboration with clinicians, scientists, myself. But Paytel was not interested in doing service. He was only interested in doing research. And so I had learned enough then that I could actually do the cytogenetic evaluation and analysis. And so I continued this with Dave Smith. Dave Smith eventually decided to go to the state of Washington. And replacing him was another pediatrician interested in congenital malformations, mental retardation. His name was John Opitz. And for a number of years then, we carried on this collaboration where I did the laboratory analysis for all the patients that John would see.
Could I ask, what was going on in Milwaukee all this time? Were you doing all the work for the Milwaukee hospitals also?
We were the first cytogenetics laboratory in the state. Now, some people thought that cytogenetics was, since it was something you could visualize, that they could do it. And some private clinical labs tried to do cytogenetics, but after a while, most of them realized that you really needed some expertise in this analysis, and so.
But was Milwaukee sending tissue samples and pap smear samples?
Well, eventually they, as I say, when we did train enough people, they also then would hire a cytotechnologist to be able to do their own, So it eventually this did disperse throughout the state. Mm-hmm. But we started it, and so the the cytogenetics laboratory, for example, Opitz was a tireless worker, and he started doing some large surveys. For example, he went out to what's called the Central Colony, it's now the Central Center, where people are hospitalized because of severe mental retardation. And we surveyed the entire population there to see what sort of things would show up. And so this, meant a very large workload. One of the things that helped us was advances in the field of cytogenetics. For example, at first we had to do nothing but tissue, where you had to mince pieces of skin or other from other sources, grow them out in tissue culture until they would spread onto the surface of the vessel, and then cells would divide. And once you got them in division, you would be able to analyze them. And then there were some improvements in the way you could spread cells by using colchicine to stop cell division and metaphase, and then hypotonic solution so that they would spread out. So there were many improvements, but it was still, at first, fairly crude. Eventually, other techniques helped to identify individual chromosomes, and so the field then was vastly improved by these developments.
What kind of samples did you take besides skin?
Well, pretty soon.
And did you have to get permission from all the parents of these children that were out there? In those days?
In those days, I'm not sure how the permission was given, but when we did family studies, for example, families would come in and we would obviously get permission from them. We could also work on blood samples. That really made it better. You could then grow out cells, the lymphocytes that would start to divide again, right? Eventually also, where gynecologists became involved, was a technique was developed to get amniotic fluid. And so you could then do first trimester, second trimester amniocentesis and grow out cells to see if there were chromosomal abnormalities present in the fetus. So that also became a large part of our activity. Also, cytogenetics then became used for malignancies, such as what's known as the Philadelphia chromosome, which is identified with chronic myelogenous leukemia. So a whole field of cancer cytogenetics evolved. And the laboratory evolved also as new applications were being developed. So getting back into the, say, the 1960s, in my early phase of my career, I ran a cytogenetics laboratory. We had lots of publications, which enabled me to get promoted and to get tenure. But then in 1966, Dr. Evans took a position at Yale University, where he had been previously, to head up World Health Organization Serum Bank. And while he was at Wisconsin, he had also developed a serum bank from specimens that were sent to our laboratory for infectious diseases. And he'd also helped to develop a computerized system of data storage, which was new when he developed it at the state lab. So we were really very well prepared to do epidemiologic studies. And a lot of papers got published in this field of epidemiology.
And this was all still located in SMI?
No, by this time we had moved to the building on Henry Mall. Mm. In 1953, this building was completed.
Yes, oh. Right, yeah.
So we outgrew the SMI, and so Stovall was able to get some federal grant money and state money in order to build this building. Right? So after Evans left in 1966, I was appointed the director of the state lab and still had my appointment in pathology and was teaching in pathology, giving lectures to the medical students, helping in the laboratory, and also continuing my research in cytogenetics. I'd also hired somebody to head up that laboratory so that, because I obviously couldn't do all of this. And this laboratory continues until today. And the only glitch along the way in cytogenetics was that after Opitz left and other people were doing the clinical cytogenetics, they decided that they wanted to have a laboratory at Weizmann Center. And even though I opposed this, a laboratory was open and operated there for a number of years until very recently, when Weizmann Center made the decision to abandon its cytogenetics laboratory, and it was merged into the state lab cytogenetics laboratory. Now, I should get back to the period when Evans left in 1966 and I became director of the lab. We had no immediate person to replace Evans as chair of preventive medicine. And so an acting director was appointed, but the courses had to be carried on. And somehow I had to carry on the third year course in chronic disease epidemiology. I guess it was a second year course, actually. First year was infectious disease. And so I was really not prepared to give all the lectures that Evans had, and so I used a lot of invited speakers, and we carried this on. Eventually, John Rankin assumed the chair of preventive medicine, and so it was then his responsibility to carry out these programs. During my tenure as director of the state lab, we expanded into various types of activities that were not previously conducted at the state lab, because one of the first things that happened when I became director was the passage of Medicare and what is known as the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Act, or CLIA, which for the first time made federal regulations of clinical laboratories. And so it was a very momentous time for laboratories. And it designated laboratories as either hospital-associated, independent, that would be independent of hospitals and also of doctor's offices. And the third category would be doctor's offices laboratory. And CLIA had certification process, an accreditation process for hospital-based and independent laboratories. And so I was very much involved with people at CDC and other public health agencies in creating the regulations for laboratories. And at first they were really quite simple. What they did was develop standards. In other words, a hospital laboratory who wanted to do microbiology had to meet certain standards. The same would be true for clinical chemistry. And there would be an inspection system to determine if they were meeting these minimal standards. In my view, this greatly improved the level of laboratory testing in this country, because when we went out to some of the private small hospital laboratories in Wisconsin, we were amazed at the lack of appropriate practices that were going on. So it really taught people what they really needed to do in order to conduct laboratory testing. And so it was called CLIA 67. It was passed in 1967. And it started the whole process of laboratory regulation. And these CLIA regs were updated in 1988 much more strictly. And so today, laboratories in this country do have to meet certain standards. CLIA 88, where in which I was also involved, took the giant step of including doctor's office labs, much to the dismay of the medical societies, as you can imagine. And so today, all laboratories that do testing on specimens from humans have to meet certain appropriate standards. So regulation became a big part of the things I had to be involved in the early days. And I helped to set up regulations for cytology labs, which were kind of unregulated also. So it was kind of an interesting period, and the regulations keep changing, and there are lots of activities that people have to do in terms of reporting and keeping records of what they do. For example, when you run a test today, say on a machine that does chemistry, you have to put in certain standards and controls to make sure the machine is running properly, but then you have to keep records so that if somebody comes back and they wonder why is this test value such and such, you can show them that indeed the system was working and this test, the result is correct. Other things that involved me when I was director of the state lab were had to do with what we might call panel testing, where machines were developed that could do, say, 3, 4, 12 different tests on a single blood sample. They call chemistry panels. And because of the availability of this, which really made the laboratory testing very cheap to do, people came interested in doing what were called executive physicals, and where you could go in and have all kinds of tests done to see how your liver was doing and your kidneys and risk for heart disease and so forth. So because, again, this was new and it was really public health in the sense that you could predict how a person's health might be, our state Department of Health became very interested. Previously, the Department of Health had done some screening tests in terms of chest x-rays for tuberculosis, which used to be very common important disease, doing blood pressure readings, blood sugar readings. But with this new strength of chemical testing, they decided that they would take these vans, which had been previously used primarily for chest x-rays to go around the state, to include all these other things. And so they had five vans which were put into service to go all around Wisconsin, where people could come in and without any charge have chest x-rays, blood pressure, chemical panel, and for women, they could have a pap test. And so it was really quite the deal, where they would set up in shopping malls or church parking lots, and they would be advertised that you can come in and have these tests run. So this program lasted for several years, and our laboratory did all of the panels and pap smears, so it's kind of interesting.
Now, I heard Tommy Thompson speak Friday, yes. Saturday night, and he mentioned that, and I'd read this before, that the people who came on to Medicare mm-hmm. were going to have a physical so that they could tell them, help them to keep healthy and mm-hmm. and control any problems that they might be starting to have or something like that. What is that going to do to the state hygiene lab?
Well, most people are going to get their health care some local clinic or hospital, so the state lab won't be getting that sort of work, I don't think, from what you're explaining. But I know Secretary Thompson does have the religion of prevention now, and you may have seen where recently he and the Department of Health and Human Services has said that the biggest epidemic now today is obesity, mm-hmm. and it's surpassing the effects of smoking, which has been the number one cause of preventable diseases. So he is really taking this very seriously, and so I imagine it ties into this interest. Mm-hmm. Other things that happened during my years as a director included infectious diseases, in that we had several scares, including the Legionnaires' disease, the swine flu scare, and obviously more recently, AIDS. So infectious diseases are still very important in the state lab, and I was involved in, you know, in making sure that testing got developed. And in infectious diseases, we would have workshops for laboratory people from hospitals around the state, and extension teaching was a very important part of our activities. Now, during the time I was director of the state lab and still involved in pathology, the pathology department had problems after Dr. Angevine resigned. A person who replaced him was one of my colleagues in pathology, Peter Burkholder. And Peter was chairman of the pathology department for several years, but developed a severe case of hepatitis and stepped down as chairman. And then I think that Henry Pito became chairman for a short time, but when Harold Rush retired as director of McArdle, Pito was appointed director, and he then resigned as chairman of pathology. And so then we had acting chairman until we could find a new permanent chairman for pathology. And nobody wanted to be acting chairman, and several people in the department prevailed upon me to become acting chairman, which I needed like a hole in the head, I suppose, because of a very turbulent time in the department. And the problem was, we would bring out some very good candidates from around the country, but as I sort of alluded, the space in the pathology department was not ideal. It was poorly funded, poorly staffed. And when we bring in people, plus the salaries here were extremely low, you know, there's no chance of getting good people. So my tenure as acting chairman was dragging on. And I was involved in another very big activity, and that was to write the first major book, not to write, but to edit the first major book on laboratory quality assurance. And this was a joint effort between the American Public Health Association and CDC. And about 1974, I believe, a very large conference was held at CDC in Atlanta. And I was chairing this conference with about several hundred laboratory scientists from every field, not only clinical laboratory field, but environmental laboratories, water chemistry, air chemistry, occupational health, and all of the different disciplines in the clinical laboratories. And the idea was to have separate chapters on each laboratory discipline and five general chapters on quality assurance, on statistical aspects of quality assurance, and so forth. So this was a major undertaking because it was the first effort for this. And so I had people, committees for each chapter, somebody heading it up, and had to get their manuscripts, edit them. And the APHA gave me a copy editor in Madison, and it took several years to get this book out. So I was doing all this, and after 2 years as acting chairman, I said, I can't do it anymore. Another person from the department was appointed. He did it for a year. I finished the book. I came back for another year. And at this time, we were doing some more searches, but with no luck. And people were leaning on me. And finally, against my better wishes, I did accept the chairmanship of pathology.
How many deans were you dealing with through all this?
Well, Crowley was one, and then when he left, his assistant, Bernie Nelson, became the acting dean. So I finally did agree, and then after Bernie Nelson left, then Bud Brown came. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I assumed the chairmanship, and after a short period of time, I gave up the directorship of the state lab, and the person who succeeded me at the state lab was Ron Lessig, who was in charge of clinical chemistry, and he prevailed upon me to accept the title of medical director of the state lab because he still wanted me to head up the pathology section and other things. So I did then become the medical director of the state lab and chairman of pathology. I tried to revitalize the pathology department, and this time we were developing a practice plan, and so I tried to make this as fair as possible. I should mention that I did not accept the chairmanship without one condition, and that was that all of the clinical laboratories should be part of the pathology department, because the people in the hospital clinical labs were all in medicine, and it was not the appropriate place for them. And they all wanted to be out of that department. So, and then, of course, Frank Larson had to agree. And he was a little reluctant, but he did agree to this arrangement. So we formed then a department of pathology and laboratory medicine.
And, that was in 78.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. So...
I think we better stop here. Okay.
We were talking about my taking over as chairman of pathology and incorporating the clinical laboratories into a cohesive department. Things were also changing at the medical school in the sense that teaching was changing. Now, pathology used to have courses that were very important in my view. In the second year, we would teach pathology throughout the probably most of the second year period, and starting out with general pathology and then all of the different organ systems. Also then, we had a course in laboratory medicine, which was a full semester course, where we taught medical students the basics of laboratory operation. Well, with the changes in the medical curriculum, they went to the designation of pathophysiology in the second year, where they try to combine the basic sciences with clinical science. Now, the only problem here was that some of the basic science departments wanted no part of this. So anatomy, for example, wanted to teach their own separate courses. And so they still do teach gross pathology and histology in the first year. Microbiology also wasn't happy with this, nor was physiology. So it didn't really turn out the way it could have, as, for example, was done at Case Western Reserve, where they truly do have an integrated first and second year curriculum. However, pathology did agree to go along, and so the idea was that we would teach general pathology in the first year. The second year of pathophysiology, we would teach pathology in each of the organ systems. But it turned out that whoever was in charge, whoever was chairman of the course in, you know, liver disease or cardiovascular disease, would call all the shots. So pathology might or might not get a fair period of time to do its teaching. And what has happened in this during the early period and today is that most of the laboratory experience has been pretty much deleted. And teaching is mostly now by lectures and small discussion groups. And pathology has even evolved to the point where in some courses they don't even look at use microscopes. They have digitalized images of various conditions, diseases, gross and tissue pathology. And so medical students aren't really using wet laboratories. And this is true not only for pathology, but I think for microbiology and all the other sciences. But during my period, we did try to make sure that there was fair pathology teaching in each of the organ systems. And we had some pathology department people. One example was Enid Gilbert, who was very well known in cardiovascular pathology. And she was a very strong individual, and she made sure that pathology was included in her teaching. So I was, my particular interest somehow got turned to male and female reproductive tracts because of all the experience I had in pap smears and female diseases. And so my major activities were in both the male and female courses in the second year, and worked with the urologists in the male reproductive system and the gynecologist in the second year. And I felt these were very productive teaching programs. In the female reproductive system, for example, we developed a program for malignancies of the female reproductive tract, and I taught along with among others, Dee Beekler, and we had course. We would give lower female reproductive tract, uterus, ovaries, and she would give the clinical portion. I would give the pathology, and it was very well coordinated. I was chair of the male reproductive tract for quite a few years, and I brought in people from the anatomy department who could give the overview of the development of the male reproductive system, had several urologists who gave various parts, and again, I felt it was very well integrated and very well presented. After a couple of years, though, it was the pathology department, pathology and laboratory medicine departments, were under a lot of financial stress because there were some problems at the administrative level, and the dean started cutting some of the functions of the department. He did away with our electron microscopy program, and I was getting a lot of grief from other members of the department for things that were out of my control. And after a couple of years, I decided I didn't really need this. And so I resigned as chairman of the pathology and just went back to being a department member and medical director of the state lab.
So now this was Bud Brown?
Bud Brown, yes, who was a pathologist.
He was a pathologist himself.
Who either went over, went overboard to show that he wasn't showing partiality to pathology, but it was an impossible situation, and over which I had no control, whereas when I was director of the state lab, at least I could determine, you know, what should be done and how it should be done. And so for the last period of my tenure at Wisconsin, I was medical director of the State Laboratory of Hygiene, very much involved in all the changes going on in the healthcare system, which has been very fascinating. Maybe I can turn now just to some of the activities sort of outside of the university. As an academic, of course, you're involved in professional societies, and so I've been involved in quite a few. There are professional pathology societies, and so I've been involved, for example, with the American Society of Clinical Pathologists, and doing workshops and courses for people at national meetings. Perhaps I've been more involved with the American Society of Cytology, which is now called Cytopathology, and also involved there with courses and workshops, and eventually became president of the society, and later on received their Papanicolaou Award for my contributions. Have been a volunteer with the American Cancer Society since 1967 at the request of Dr. Stovall, who had been one of the founders of the Wisconsin division of the American Cancer Society. So I try to carry on his tradition, and with my interest in the Pap smear and prevention of cancer, this was a natural. And so since 1967, I've been active in various parts of the American Cancer Society and have served on the Wisconsin Divisional Board, and for 8 years at the National Board, which at that time was in New York City, and was present also at the time when it was moved to Atlanta, the national office. We've had several programs that we've developed in the American Cancer Society. I was chair of a committee that developed a program in about 1987 where we tried to increase the utilization of mammography, just as we had tried to increase the utilization of the Pap smear. And so we developed a program wherein radiology services would offer a low-cost mammogram for $50 or less, and offer it to women who would come in, and the only stipulation was they had to be a certain age and not have had a mammogram within the past year. And hopefully we'd get lots of women who had never had mammograms. It was a very successful program. We cooperated with the state Division of Public Health, which has a radiation safety program to make sure that the units were proper. The biggest problem I had trying to get this program off the ground was with the radiologists who were not used to the idea that people could come in without a referral and ask for a radiogram. So I had to go before the State Society and explain to them it was just a demonstration project. It was to increase the utilization of mammography. And eventually they agreed. And it was a very successful program. And since that time, the utilization rate of mammography has, you know, greatly increased, not partially due to this demonstration project.
Was this done in vans, or did you say they were in shopping centers, though?
Well, there are some vans that do this, but at that time it was mostly fixed units in major clinics or hospitals, right? Mm-hmm. So the Cancer Society has always been an interest. I'm on a program right now where Wisconsin has gotten money from CDC to develop a statewide comprehensive cancer control plan. So we're working through this now, trying to develop this. I've also done a lot of volunteering locally with non-scientific activities, primarily in the field of music. And as I mentioned, when I was in high school and college, I played the violin in orchestras and chamber groups. And even in medical school, I organized a chamber quartet and played at some of the school functions there. And when I came to Madison, I still had my violin. And one day, one of my neighbors said he was going to try out for the Madison Symphony. So he was the school orchestra conductor at West High School. So I said, Hiram, I'll go with you. So I went, and I played in the Madison Symphony for 6 or 7 years until it got to be too much with my other requirements. Since then, though, I've been active as a board member of the Madison Symphony, and all of our children somehow became musicians, and my older son took up the violin, my daughter took up the cello, and we told my younger son he had to play the viola. So we did have a quartet, and they're all very good musicians, and we did play mostly at church and things like that. And then they also joined what's known as Wisconsin Youth Symphony Orchestras. And so we became parents on the board, and since then, Shirley and I have both been very active in the Wisconsin Youth Symphony Orchestras. As a matter of fact, these last 2 weekends, there have been concerts. One of these we had, and Lynn Harrell, a world-renowned cellist playing with the orchestras, and it's been very, very worthwhile. So we do a lot of volunteering. I retired in 1998 when I became 70 years old and decided I worked long enough. I had 39 years actually as a university faculty, although my tenure here was actually longer because I was a resident and intern. And so I've been in Madison since 1953. Love it, love the community. There's so much doing here in terms of events that one can enjoy, musical and cultural. We've never taken winter vacations. We are not snowbirds. We stay here. We find lots of things to do in the wintertime.
As I recall, you used to take trips where you'd go into a state.
Well, we do this. We A-state our states. What we do is when our children were growing up, again, salaries were not great at the university, and we didn't have a lot of money, so we just piled the kids into our car, and we would take off for certain parts of the country. And this way, we've seen every state in the Union. Of course, for Hawaii and Alaska, we had to go. Our children not with us, but since then, we've been to those states too. But we did it very cheaply. We would we always stayed in a motel, but we would always get some food along the way and have breakfast in the room. We have a little picnic lunch someplace in a city park or something. In the evening, we would, you know, go to a restaurant, have a meal, get some more food for the next day. So it was very reasonable. All of us pile into one room, and the kids would, we'd have one cot and two twin beds. And
it was fun, too.
It was fun, yeah.
Yeah.
And the kids were very good, and we keep them busy. And, mm-hmm. and our older son is doing this now with his children, and he is also, he's a violinist, as I mentioned, and his wife is a cellist, and their two kids play violin and viola, so they have their own quartet, so we've spawned a lot of musicians.
And you're still playing?
I'm still playing, yeah.
Does Shirley play also?
She plays a piano, and Shirley...
Oh, that's good.
Volunteers, she plays out at the nursing home once a week, and, you know, plays songs for the residents.
Mm-hmm.
So, we just love music, and we go down to the university for a lot of the faculty recitals and whatever else we can take in.
That's wonderful. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
Well, I think that covers a lifetime, sort of, in a, you know, an hour or so.
With a broad brush.
Right.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Inhorn.
It's been my pleasure, Anne.
When I started this, I forgot to mention that this is March 15th, the year 2004. Right.